Possibilities.
Collaborative.
Collaboration.
Positive and optimistic.
Expanding.
Pure light.
Welcome to Regenerative Voices, Elevating Stories, Activating Change. I'm Celine Diaris, the host of our podcast and the co-founder of At the Epicenter. I am delighted today to have a longtime friend and ally in the organic food world, Bob Quinn, who's an organic farmer and also a recent author of a new book called Grain by Grain, which we'll be talking a bit about during our conversation today. Bob, thank you so much for joining me.
Celine, it's my pleasure and my honor. I'm looking forward to it.
Fantastic. Well, I think where I want to jump is having been reading your book, I'm not completely finished, full disclosure, but I am halfway through and have found the style of your writing and the creation of this book just deeply accessible to someone like myself who knows something, but also if I didn't know a lot, I know that the way you're presenting information is just very understandable, and I appreciate you for doing it that way. So I think for a lot of people, understanding what it is about agriculture that is the challenge of the conventional farmer transitioning to organic production. I would love it if you could walk us through some of the story of how you experienced that transition and both the challenge and then ultimately how quickly you started to see the benefit and reward of pursuing organic.
Okay, great. Well, first of all, can I share with you one of my pet peeves? And that
yes.
is that chemical farmers are calling themselves conventional. And to me, conventional is what we've been doing for the last 10,000 years. What we've been doing for the last 70 years, to me, is a great chemical experiment. And now we're starting to see the wheels are starting to come off the bus, actually. And even before I was ready to start transitioning 30 years ago, people were already having to use more and more chemicals to get the same result because the soil no longer provided the life for the plants that it formerly had. And they needed more chemical fertilizer, for example, to take its place of what the living soil used to do. And now we have such things as Roundup ready weeds that are resistant to Roundup and other herbicides. We have all kinds of pesticide residues in our food. So anyway, just to be real brief and real clear about that, I'd like to refer to the chemical farmers as non-organic farmers, because to me they're all potentially organic farmers, regenerative organic farmers, and that's what I like to think of them as. And when we started about 30 years ago, it wasn't out of necessity or out of a goal to change the world. I was intrigued by friends of mine who were growing fertilizers and substituting plants for fertilizer and actually growing without chemicals. And I'm intrigued by that. My background is science and plants, and that's my love. And when I found neighbors who said they could have just as good a crops, just as high a quality, and just as few weeds without chemicals as I had with chemicals that I've been using, grew up with all my life and farmed with for 10 years, I was intrigued by that. And I started experimenting with it. One of the things that we had seen in our farm is that we were getting further and further behind financially because of the cost of the chemicals and the low prices we're receiving for our grain. I had helped modify that a little bit by sending our grain directly to whole grain bakers who wanted high protein wheat from Montana. And we received a dollar more a bushel when wheat was about $3 a bushel. So that was a 30% premium. That was a big help to us.
But right.
As the years went on, we still weren't keeping up. We had two families now trying to be supported on the farm I was raised on, my parents and myself and my family. And it was a 2,400 acre wheat and cattle ranch, big enough for one family, but really not big enough for two. Mm-hmm. And so we were in a squeeze. And I was very intrigued with the premiums that were being received by organic at that point. And so I was interested in the economics and also the science. And I did 2 years of experimentation, and they're both fantastically successful. And I was an instant convert. And 1988, I used my last chemical on our whole farm. And that's been over 30 years ago.
So what's interesting to me, particularly when you talk about you were already seeing yourself as a farmer, the pressure of profitability due to the cost of inputs. And this was even predates the introduction of genetically modified seeds,
yep.
which I think would be interesting for you to say a little bit about how that has created a very potent context that farmers are absolutely in a cycle of having to spend an inordinate amount of money on inputs in order to actually grow these, you know, supposedly the panacea to feed the world, genetically modified seeds.
Well, of course, we don't have genetically modified wheat yet. So it's not because Monsanto didn't want it. It's because our customers generally, and our customers for Asia, Korea, Japan, maybe a little of Taiwan, they didn't want it. And so Monsanto was forced to back off on their genetically modified wheat. They're ready to release it, really. So what I'm seeing a little bit from afar of my neighbors, and I have to go to Dakotas for this, growing corn and soybeans in eastern Dakota, at least where it starts, they are forced, just like you said, to buy seed every year. They can no longer save their own seed. So now they have a new input cost they didn't used to have. They have chemicals that they're required to buy to raise that crop. Even before we were organic, we would sometimes, if we had a very good winter wheat stand in the spring that choked out weeds, we didn't even spray because the wheat was so dense that there were very few weeds showing up. With the Roundup Ready crops, that's not really an option. You have to use their chemicals. And to me, it makes the farmers closer and closer to the days of serfdom. It makes it like a serf. The difference is we own our land, and the only other difference is the castle's gone. The castle's in St. Louis.
That's right. The castle's in St. Louis and or Germany now.
Now in Germany. And so, but the farmers are just living almost under the control of chemical companies who are almost prescribing their every move, particularly in production. And I think that's a very, very dangerous situation to be at high risk.
I agree, and I think it's interesting. I don't think I realized that where you are, it's not really corn country, it's wheat country.
Yep.
And as opposed to your brethren growing in the Dakotas, that is where more corn and soy, and then I know obviously down in Kansas, that's another big cropping area. What are they growing in Kansas?
Into the Midwest. Into the Midwest, you go into corn and soy, a little bit of wheat in the rotation. Kansas, Western Kansas is much like we are, dry and mostly wheat country. But as you go east into where the short grass prairie becomes the tall grass prairie, or in former days, then you have enough rain with tall grass prairie to grow corn and soybeans. And that's what they do. And those are very intensively chemically grown and controlled.
So I know that you have a very interesting background, which makes you like a farmer with a PhD. And I think that is also a very refreshing aspect for us to appreciate. You know, farmers come from many different cloths. And I've met quite a number of farmers in my work who have graduate degrees who come back to the land to either step back into a family operation, or they've just felt a calling to get into agriculture firsthand. So I would love if you would share a bit about what that was like for you to go off to university and pursue not just a master's, but then to go into a PhD program and what you were studying there. And then how did you find yourself back on the farm?
Well, I grew up loving plants and science, and all through high school, that was my favorite things to do, was grow a big garden and do experiments and also do science projects in school. And so I went off to college at Montana State University studying botany, and then I got a master's studying plant pathology. And then my major professors were from UC Davis, and they said, you know, now, and this is 66, this is when I graduated from high school, 1970, I graduated from college. In 71, I got my master's, and they said at that time, early 70s, the plant science really was at the biochemistry level as far as the new frontier. So they encouraged me to go off to Davis, UC Davis, and study biochemistry, and that's what I did. When I got there, I found that the biochemistry has to be done in a laboratory. And I found that sitting in a bench week after week, month after month, wasn't as fulfilling as when I was out in the field studying plant disease and actually growing things. Mm. And so I felt a little bit unfulfilled. And it was, then I also was a little disillusioned with the way the university research, cartel was formed. It was one lab against another lab for grant money. And that's why I use cartel. I mean, that's a little bit of a kind term maybe, but that's what it was. It was like almost dog eat dog, and there was a big fight and competition for grants. In fact, we were told not to even discuss our research with a lab in Riverside where we're going for a conference, because that lab was in direct competition with our lab for the next round of grants.
And that's almost counterproductive to the very essence of what scientific rigor should entail, which should be cross-pollination of ideas and exploration to further science. So I can appreciate how that felt off to you. That sounds off to me as well.
It didn't feel natural. It didn't feel fun. It wasn't fun. And so I left university after getting my degree, rather than going on for postdoctorate graduate fellowships, because there's very few jobs, and because PhDs were now in great abundance. The federal government program to support science after Sputnik went off, and we felt we were behind in science. There was a lot of money poured into scientific research and also supporting the education of scientists. So I was a benefactor of that. I came out of 10 years of college with no debt because I had fellowships all the time and grants all the time. And we were living on $200 a month. I mean, it's a different age than now. Students can't even do that now. But
you couldn't live on $200 a week today.
Yeah. So it was a different
day
time.
Almost. I mean.
it was a different time. I mean, now some of my kids and their spouses have come out of college with $100,000 of debt. This is insane.
It is insane.
We need a different system than that. But anyway, in those days, all kinds of people in my position took advantage of the fellowships, and they resulted in a glut of PhDs in the mid to late 70s, which is about how long it took for that program to come to fruition. And so I started a small business of my own in California for a couple of years, and then I decided to come back to the farm. And it was a farm that had been in our family since 1920. It was a wheat and cattle ranch. I knew how to run it. My dad was still there, and we farmed together, and we got along famously very well. It was a great partnership, and he was getting ready to retire. He was getting ready actually to become Montana's Montana president of Montana Farm Bureau. So that meant it wasn't a paid position, but it took a lot of time. And so he was happy to have me there and kind of pick up the slack while he was gallivanting around politicking and policy discussions and all that kind of stuff. So it worked well. It really worked well. And we had a great time. And so next year we're celebrating the 100th year anniversary of our farm.
Wow. And
it wasn't very long after I arrived that I turned my whole farm, the way I looked at it, into my laboratory and my garden. And now I've downsized. We grew the farm from 2,400 acres when I came 40 years ago to 4,000 today. But last year I downsized to 4 acres from 4,000 to 4 because I thought it was time to turn the farm over to the next generation. Because, you know, access to farmland is a big stumbling block for a lot of people who want to farm. And I had two guys working for me that were just fantastic. I trained them how to do organic, and last year they started leasing the whole thing. And now there's 4 families being supported by this farm.
Wow.
Organic, and they're having a great time. And now I had my turn, now it's their turn. And so I think that's been a very satisfying to see that happen. Even though it's hard to let go, and it's like, letting your kids go, but you have to. I mean, they grow up and they have to go on and have a life of their own. You can't just lord over them until you die. And that's the way, you know, some people do with their farm. And I think that's too bad, because now I've been able to help them with the transition. And if they have any questions, I'm glad to help them any way I can. But that's their project now. They're doing it. They're calling the shots. And so it's very satisfying.
Folks, members of your family, or these are all associates who worked with you when it was operated by you?
Two of them worked for me, one for 6 years and one for 2 years. So I have 5 kids, and I haven't seen any of them show back up on the farm yet. I had one that was doing a auxiliary business with me, but they decided to go to the big city of Great Falls and get a real job after 5 years of a barely scratching out a living. Although they had a house to live in, you know, and I make sure they had the table. But anyway, that's all right. People have to do what they feel most comfortable with, so that's fine. But none of them have come back to actually run the farm. And not seeing that was in the cards in the immediate future, I decided to lease it to those that were ready and wanting to do it.
That's really a beautiful story. I'm happy to know that you're in a scenario where the work that you've done is continuing forward, and that you're very satisfied with the stewardship going forward that you've got.
Yes, I'm excited about that. Right.
Yeah, that's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, that was my goal, and that's been accomplished.
So let's talk a little bit about the climate. The actual climate, and then the climate around the climate, in terms of sort of the perception or attitudes of fellow farmers. I think in your book you talk about, we know something's changing. We're seeing it on our landscape. We've watched rainfall change. We've watched temperatures change. So there's clearly something shifting.
Yeah.
Yet I know from a lot of other conversations that having the word climate change be embraced by the agricultural community has been a bit of a challenge. But it seems to me, nevertheless, that farmers are responding in their own way. Could you say a little bit about, what you've perceived in fellow farmers around this topic? And then what do you think opportunities are to broaden a conversation with farmers in the U.S. in particular?
Well, I always tell my friends who are not farmers that farmers really don't have the luxury to debate climate change, because we really have to respond to it. And whatever we call it, it's different than it was 30 years ago, for sure. And that's, I kind of take that as a challenge. I'm trying not to contribute to the problem. I think being regenerative organic is a big contributor to reducing the problem. But until everybody is that way, we have to respond to what's happening with the situation we're in. So what we've seen in our area is that spring rains are stopping sooner, and summer heat is arriving sooner.
Mm-hmm.
That puts our spring crops into more and more risk. We used to be on a line that really was right in the middle of a division, separation between spring wheat and winter wheat. If you went 100 miles south of us, it was almost all winter wheat. If you went 100 miles north, it was almost all spring wheat. That line is changed now. The spring wheat line is moving north, and we're having more and more challenge growing spring wheat because of the heat coming sooner and the rain stopping sooner, as I mentioned. So
right.
I'm experimenting with organic. We can't just grow one crop and make that work. We have to have a full range of crops for diversity and for our rotation. So I'm experimenting with growing more or planting more and more crops in the fall that traditionally were only planted in the spring. And I'm seeing some really interesting results for that, and also looking at varieties that are more, lend themselves better to winter survival, because our winters are not all mild. They're certainly milder than they used to be, but last year we still had 35 degrees below zero. It used to be 40. It used to be 40 every year. We could count on 40 to 45 below every year for a few days. And we haven't seen that for, 10 or 15 years now.
But dude, that's cold.
That is cold. Normally, luckily, when it gets that cold, normally the wind doesn't blow. So that's
that's good, because that wind chill would be scary.
Yeah, you wouldn't even want to talk about it. We don't talk about wind chill because the actual temperature is bad enough. We don't talk about it.
Yeah, I would say.
But so that's...
I had no idea it got that cold.
Yes, we're in zone 3 for the USDA zone, growing zones, and that's 40 below zero. That's where we are. But anyway, most of my neighbors, a lot of them don't really, they think that climate change is kind of a political football. Some of them are and don't really believe in what a lot of the rhetoric is, but almost everybody is modifying their farming practices to adapt to it or to respond to it, whether or not they're calling it that.
That's interesting. And so... just, you know, I noticed, I've seen where the government has actually changed the zones now.
Yeah, we're getting to be zones 4, 3.5 or 4+ or 4- or something. We're going between 3 and 4 of the growing zones. So those zones are shifting, the numbers are shifting south, or the warming is going north, however you want to look at it.
Right. The warming is going north, which is why we're concerned about what's happening in the tundras, where we're tundras and methane release with no true complete freeze happening in the winter like it has in the past. So, yeah, it's whatever you want to say about the words to speak to what's happening is real. It's expanding and accelerating.
Yeah. And if you look at Glacier Park, we have a good example right in Montana that they're estimating now in 20 more years or less, there won't be any more glaciers. So I don't know if they're going to rename it or what. But when I was a kid, there's glaciers everywhere. But they have pictures that they can document very clearly what's happened to our ice pack and just the little bit we have. And then if you go to the poles, of course, that's much more serious. But we have little things that we can see right in our backyard.
Right. Well, you know, you've been, you have some really wonderful relationships with some iconic figures, Dave Vetter, Fred Kirschemann, who have been longtime organic advocates and farmers. Can you say a little bit about how those relationships were supportive to you as you were learning the ropes and how to do organic agriculture on your farm?
Sure, because when we started, there wasn't any bulletin from Montana State or anybody else of how to convert to organic. There wasn't anything like that. We were really on our own. There weren't very many in Montana, and there weren't very many wheat farmers. There weren't any hardly any in my neighborhood. And when I went to my first food show in California, this is before we even had a booth, I think it was the 85, people told me, oh, you need to meet Fred Kirschemann. And so they pointed him out, and I ran him down in the aisle, and we got acquainted, and he was an organic farmer. Of course, he'd been going for a while, and he immediately became a friend, and he came to Montana to help us and to advise us and to share with us his knowledge. And then I would see him at food shows and several times throughout the year. And then he introduced me to what I met about the same time at the Dave Vetter, because I was associated with OCIA, which is the Organic Crop Improvement Association, which was a certifier at the time, an independent certifier. And Dave was very active in that. And he actually had been the one to get help Fred convert to organic and teach him about organic. And Dave's father had been involved back in the 50s. And so this is a guy who'd been farming for 20 years organic. And I thought, oh man, I wish I could have had that kind of a history instead of a chemical history, because he had learned so much. And I was really, envious, or I admired that. And we became good friends too. And Tom Harding was probably the other one of the trio that really helped me. Tom was from Pennsylvania, so he was out of grain country, but he was the first one who came and inspected our farm for our certification in 87, had just 20 acres. He flew out from Pennsylvania to certify or inspect 20 acres. Can you imagine that? I mean,
that was very generous.
Yes, but there weren't anybody, there weren't very many closer that would do it. And that's what he was doing. And it was through OCIA. And so we got acquainted also very early. And those three probably had the biggest influence on both my conversion and my early adoption and early experiments with organic, and also learning the philosophy of organic. And within Montana, I would say Dave Oyen, who started Timeless Seeds, was right up there too. He was another one who was several years ahead of me in his adoption of organic, and quite a mentor. Those four had more influence on me than anybody else.
I love the one of the things I am particularly moved by is that sharing mentality. Mm-hmm. That these other farmers were willing and interested in being sharing knowledge and helping to grow the number of farmers pursuing this type of, as you say, ancient form of agriculture, which had been disrupted by the Green Revolution, which is so poorly named.
Well,
so this is another piece that I'd like to talk a little bit about, is like the capacity of farmers like yourself and others to really help be a resource to other farmers who are struggling in the current treadmill, who are facing bankruptcies and even suicides in the current situation for a lot of family farmers that are stuck in the chemical treadmill. How are you experiencing or finding receptivity or even outreach to you directly from other farmers who are seeing the success you've had and want to understand how they might employ that on their own farms?
Well, I would say that I've received more calls for inquiry of how to convert to organic in the last 3 years than I have in the last 30.
Wow.
If you take the last 30 and you say, well, how many calls did you get? They're probably put them on two hands, and now I get that much probably every quarter, or well, depending on the season. I'm getting more altogether in the last 3 years than the last 30 years by far.
Wow.
So that in itself tells me that there's a lot of interest. We had our Montana Organic Association meeting last year. We had almost 200 people show up for that. That's getting close to the numbers that would attend like grain growers or farm bureau meetings, or some of the traditional farm groups that have been in existence for a century. And this has been going for 10 or 15 years now. So it's really, really starting, the ball is really starting to roll, and the momentum is building. The last farm tour we had on our farm, open house, we had also about 150 or 180 people showed up. That is also equal to what the experiment stations get in their field days. So I was very, very enheartened by that. And now the difference is that some of the neighbors are starting to come. In the early days, I mean, my neighbors would be caught dead coming to a field day here, because I was known as the weed farmer. now with the legalization of hemp, that whole has a different connotation now. But,
right. So you were just growing a lot of superfluous plants versus
That's right.
versus hemp.
That's right. And I refer to it as diversity. You know, I said, my goal is not eradication of every stray plant that we call a weed in our field. My goal was management of those to make sure that that diversity didn't get out of control and take over my cash crop. And so it's a different way of looking at it. I'm not trying to eradicate every last weed. I'm trying to use rotations and diversity and break up weed cycles and disease cycles and pest cycles also for that matter, so that the organic system can work and right. function more in balance, so the whole farm is more in balance.
So with these high turnout for these different conversations, what are you seeing in terms of the actual adoption and picking these new ideas up and applying them to these folks' farms?
Well, that's a good question. I see that it's coming a little more slowly. By and large, farmers don't know where to start. And a lot of them are just up against the wall financially, so they're really afraid to change anything very much at one time because they're already in great risk and they don't want to go out into the unknown too far. And we still don't have county agents that are trained to be organic advisors. And now another problem that has evolved over the years with the USDA taking over organic certification, the inspectors are no longer allowed to give any advice or any counsel on how to solve organic problems because they're an agent. They're an agent of the USDA, and they're not to be there to give advice or to counsel. Before the government took over organic certifications, our inspectors were really our county agents. They were our lifeline to information. If they saw a problem, we'd said, "What would you do about a problem like this?" They saw, because they were inspecting all kinds of farms, they saw all kinds of problems and solutions. And they were able to kind of be the pollinator that would take around information. You know, they didn't use names and places particularly, but they would say, "Well, I've seen this work, or I've seen that work, or I've seen this problem get worse or develop or whatever." And that was a big help to us. And when the federal government came in and prohibited that, that really set back, I think, the growth in organic at the farm level. We are behind our demand now.
That strikes me as, once again, another really short-term, not even intelligent choice.
Well, it was a non-intended consequence of a federal policy that is not very flexible and not really designed with full use of resources in mind, because they're designed to do certain things.
What about the USDA Conservation Services?
That is coming up and taking a little more of a role now. But that's taken 20 years. Mm-hmm. So now we're in 2019. The organic bill was passed in 1990. So it's been almost 30 years. It's getting close to 30 years since that was passed. And now they're starting to be, say, from the last farm bill, so the one before this one, the last 5 years, particularly the last six, because we already started the next one, they started to have a significant number of equip programs and things that would help with conversion and cover crops and other things that would help with the conversion to organic. So that's a positive thing, but that's taken quite a while, but to come along and still with that doesn't come the kind of information we normally would get from a county agent who you could call on any kind of a problem and say, what about this or that. With the equip problems, they're trained to handle the project that they have, of course, but if you have a other type of problem or a challenge, they're not really schooled to handle the broad spectrum of problems you might have in conversion.
That's fascinating. I wonder, I've had a lot of conversations also with colleagues about crop insurance and how that also is not really in the best interest of regenerative agricultural efforts, that it's actually supporting non-idyllic cropping systems, and also penalizing for better choice making on the part of farmers. Could you say a little bit about the crop insurance program and how you see that being a deterrent to better opportunities for farmers to be successful?
Sure. Well, in the beginning, the crop insurance really worked against us because organic was thought to be such a high risk that we were charged more and the recovery on losses were less. So we couldn't recover losses on higher value crops, for example, which organic crops were higher valued. Actually, our risk is lower because we are our cost of production is less. And so therefore, the whole risk of the farm is less. So that now they've improved the insurance quite a bit, but we still have some holdovers from the old ways of thinking. For example, in the Northern Great Plains, with regenerative organic agriculture, we make that work by growing green manures. We don't have enough rain to grow cover crops through the whole year. Most of us haven't got that figured out yet, but we're growing green manure crops in the springtime instead of summer fallow. And so we are covering the ground until mid-June when we terminate those mostly with the cultivator, leaving the most of the residue on top of the ground. And if it's heavy enough, it's like a mulch. So it's mulch in the ground for the whole rest of the season, which is quite also positive. But the insurance and some of the government programs recognize that in many places as continuous cropping and don't give us credit for actually research that we did on our farm almost 30 years ago when we were experimenting with yellow blossom sweet clover. And we showed that if you terminated that by mid-June, that it was used no more water than summer fallow for the whole summer with black fallow, because of the transpiration of black fallow and the working of it every 3 or 4 weeks, you lose a lot of moisture from that. And so
I don't know what black fallow is.
Well, black fallow means that you're not growing anything on that field. You're just cultivating it every 3 or 4 weeks to kill all the weeds, saving the moisture so you can grow a crop the next year. So in the Northern Great Plains where we are, we can only grow a crop every 2 years. And the off year we fallow it, which means we don't grow a crop. We don't allow anything to grow. And the chemical guys are now chem fallowing. So they're spraying with Roundup. So even though we don't have Roundup ready wheat, half of the ground in Montana now, just about half of the crop ground, is sprayed with Roundup 3 or 4 times during the season, the fallow season, to keep weeds, or 2 or 3 times, depending on how the rains come. But anyway, several times a year during the fallow season to keep weeds from coming, and they call that no-till. And so that's really touted as the wonderful savior of soil and everything else. But when you put Roundup on your soil, you're actually killing the microbiology in that soil.
Yeah, that's a misappropriation of the notion of no-till as far as the regenerative are concerned, if you're using that kind of chemical treatment.
So they're calling it no-till because they've substituted Roundup for a cultivation implement. And that's what they call no-till in the Upper Great Plains. And that's not what you envision when you go further east and into the Midwest. When they talk about the no-till and being able to drill into crops that have been terminated in other ways and never left the ground bare. So it's a different way of thinking.
Yeah, it is a different way of thinking. Interesting. I was unaware of that being what was termed no-till in the wheat state. You know, and I also understand something that you also talk about in your book, that one of the issues that has become rather prevalent in the United States and other parts of the world, but in particular in the U.S., is gluten intolerance. And there are different theories as to what has propagated this broader response. But one of the things that I have heard is that wheat fields are sprayed with glyphosate before harvest. Mm-hmm. And you can tell us a little bit about why, but I understand it has something to do with the ripening of the wheat germ or preserving something in terms of the harvest. And that is all on the wheat as a residue when it leaves the farm and goes to be processed.
Yes. So the question of wheat sensitivity now is a very big one. Mm-hmm. As a wheat farmer, I was quite frustrated and insulted, or I don't know what else you'd call it, unhappy when I discovered that a growing percent, and now it's up to between 12 and 20% of our population here in America, can no longer eat wheat and tolerate it successfully. They have all kinds of pains or indigestion or whatever, cramps, whatever, rashes in some cases. And so I had started studying that really as a result of growing ancient wheat that people told me they could not eat modern wheat, but they could eat ancient wheat that we were growing. We were selling it under the Kamut trademark. And so I started researching that because of my science background. I was very curious of what had happened, what was the difference. And after about 10 or 15 years, we published 31 peer-reviewed journal articles. Most of the research is done in Italy because they were very interested in this problem in Italy. I couldn't find very much interest 20 years ago in America to consider that maybe the wheat was a problem. No one wanted to admit that. It's kind of like climate change today. It's really interesting how people can be in denial. And a lot of the wheat breeders are just refusing to believe that there's anything the matter with their product that they've been creating or breeding, releasing right to the farmers, and then of course onto the bakers and then to the public. But now I have come to the conclusion that it's really much more complex than just gluten. And you've mentioned one of the factors that's in addition to gluten. But what's going on, and I tell people if they really have a problem with wheat, unless they're celiac. Now, celiac is a different disease. It's gluten intolerance, and they cannot, they're kind of over the top for that.
Right.
I've got an opportunity to look at the non-celiac population. There are four things that if you're in that group, that 12 to 20% that's not celiac but wheat sensitive, there's four things that if you will do, you'll probably have 95% chance of being able to enjoy wheat again. And the first one is to eat organic. And that speaks to the question or statement that you're making about the glyphosate. Glyphosate is a disruptor of a certain metabolic pathway that's found only in plants. And that's why Monsanto said how wonderful it was. It didn't affect humans or mammals or anything, because the main mode of action is the disruption of this metabolic pathway that will kill a plant because it's producing an essential amino acid it needs, and without that it dies. But what else it kills is bacteria. So because it kills bacteria, it's also destroying the bacteria in the soil. But another place that bacteria live besides the soil is our gut. And there's more bacteria cells in our gut than human cells in our body. And if you start disrupting those and causing trouble with those, you start raising all kinds of havoc and creating problems that most people are describing as wheat sensitivity. They're very close to what digestive problems, usually other kind of maladies that are a result of this traces of pesticide. The trouble is that with glyphosate, it comes with surfactants and other things that cause the glyphosate to enter the body much more easily than just glyphosate by itself. All the research has just been done on glyphosate. If they do it on Roundup, they would see a much more serious herbicide that we're dealing with here for human health. But they don't do that. So that's the second thing. So, or the first thing is organic. The second thing is to eat only heirloom or ancient wheat. So wheat has been around more than before World War II, I say, and really hasn't been changed very much. Because since then, we've changed the wheat a lot to increase yields, made it shorter, we made it more disease resistant. I'm not sure if that really is affecting the sensitivity too much, although every time you change something, it's like adding a pebble to a glass of water. You've got a pebble now in the glass of water, but some of the water has come out. And I think that water is nutrition. And we're losing nutrition on our modern breeds of crops, almost no matter what they are. If they're focusing on yield, they've lost some nutrition. So you're losing some nutrition. But what the bakers have decided that they want is more bread for less wheat. And the way they were able to get that is make gluten more complex and more elastic so it holds more air. So now we have the air bread that we all know and love in America is made with less wheat because it has more air in it. And so imagine if you're a baker, you can sell air for the price of bread. I mean, this is wonderful, huh?
This is wonderful. You know, that is a very interesting point because I lived in Europe for many years, and the breads in the Netherlands in particular were dense.
Yes, yes.
Very dense, hearty, beautiful, rich, fabulously nutty tasting breads that were almost all kind of locally made and artisan crafted bread. And it's like their standard breakfast is to have coffee and bread. And that bread is nothing like bread in this country. To your point, bread in this country is light and has lots of space in between the grains, as opposed to that really dense, much more seemingly nutritious bread that you can find in most European countries.
And when people go to Europe and say they can't eat American wheat, and they say they have no trouble eating European wheat and breads there. And I think that's what's telling me that the European wheats have certainly been improved for yield and disease resistant, but they have not changed the gluten to make a different type of this air bread that we have in America. They didn't have to mess with that because their typical traditional bread doesn't call for that. And so they didn't change that very much. The other thing that they did in America, so number two is to eat ancient grains or heritage wheats. Number three, has to do with the way the bakers bake the bread in America. They're using mostly fast rising yeast. And that yeast works so fast, it only has time to ferment the sugar that they add to the dough. Well, if you're making sourdough, people don't even add sugar to that. They do long fermentations, and the starch in the grain is broken down to produce sugar, which is what starch becomes when it's broken down. So it adds some natural sweetness. But also, you're pre-digesting the gluten. In fact, a 48-hour fermentation will pre-digest 96 to 97% of all the gluten in the bread. That's a little longer than what's normally done, but any fermentation that's overnight or 24 hours is going to reduce significantly the amount of gluten or the complexity of the gluten in that dough.
Wow.
And that makes it easier to digest because it's partly digested before you eat it. I mean, we don't think of it that way, but that's what it is. It's simpler compounds in that fermented bread, that sourdough bread. So number three is to eat sourdough. And the number four is probably not so much with sensitivity, but again, it goes back to nutrition, and that's to eat whole grain. With white flour, we're throwing away about a third of the nutrition. It's in wheat, our B vitamins, which of course it's fortified back into white flour, but there's lots of other compounds that are lost. The bran is lost, which is really good for keeping things moving through your digestive system, lots of fiber, so it works better. And if we would eat whole grains instead of white flour, we would also be better off. So if you do those four things, you'll probably have almost no problems eating wheat.
Thank you for that. That's very instructive and interesting to me about the ancient grain. And I would love for you to share a little about this story, both going to a fair and encountering the guy with the little jar telling you this was the Pharaoh's Tutankhamun's grain, and then later how you created a market globally for this kamut in changing and bringing an ancient grain to life back in the fields of Montana.
Well, all right. Well, that is a long story. It starts about 1950 with a member of the Air Force from our county serving in Portugal, and he went to a bar one night, and the guy next to him said, "Ah, look what I got from a tomb in Egypt." And he was showing him this jar of this giant-sized kernels. And the fellow came from a wheat growing family in Montana, and he's talked him out of about 30 or 40 kernels they sent to his dad. And he claimed that this other guy had claimed that he had went to Egypt on furlough and taken this out of a tomb. Well, that's probably probably not
slight exaggeration.
Probably. By 1950, most of the tombs are empty. Those that aren't are certainly being guarded. From my studies, wheat sitting in a tomb 4,000 years doesn't germinate anymore. And this stuff did germinate when it was sent home to Montana. It did grow. And
wow.
Giant wheat. It was very tall, which now I've come to understand that most ancient wheats are extremely tall. The kernels were extremely big, about three times the size of normal wheat. So that was quite a novelty. And
so I'm going to interrupt you for just one second, because for those of us who aren't farmers, we aren't even aware of like traditional, like wheat that is now hybridized, is how tall does that grow?
The semi-dwarfs that we grow are barely knee-high on a fairly average year. The old wheats on a good year would be over your head. It'd be 6 feet tall. And now the grain is maybe 2 feet tall, two and a half. So it's a big difference. And of course,
that is a big difference.
By making it shorter, they're able to increase the yields. So the whole thrust in American agriculture is to produce cheap and abundant food, but particularly cheap.
And not necessarily nutritional food or with high nutrient density, but more it's a quantity over quality.
Right. Fill you up. Keep the shelves full, keep it cheap. And I always tell people there's a very high cost of cheap food, and we can talk about that later, but that's one of my favorite pet peeves too, because a lot of people are paying for this cheap food. You don't realize it. But anyway, getting back to my tomb story, by the time the grain got to Montana, now instead of just from any tomb, now it's being called King Tut's wheat. And because you know how stories go, the more they're told, the better they get, right?
Oh, right.
And so by 1963, now that this grain had grown up, but there was no market for it. The millers didn't like it. It was so big. The bread makers didn't like it because it turns out to be a very close relative of durum. So it's hard to make normal bread with it. The pasta people would go naturally. We're making pasta that was very, very bright yellow and had a color that was rated on a scale that if it didn't make the color scale, they would reject it. It didn't make their color scale exactly with the way the modern germ
did. It was the wrong color.
It was the wrong color hue. I mean, it was close, but no cigar, right? So they didn't have a market. They didn't have a market for this. So it's just a novelty. And I remember going to the county fair and I was at, I don't know, a sophomore or so in high school, and this old guy is probably younger than I am now, but he looked pretty old to me. He had a coffee can, an old red Folgers coffee can that Folgers coffee came in those days, and he called over to me and says, "Hey, Sonny," he said, "come over here." He said, "Would you like some of King Tut's wheat?" And I said, "Oh, wow, sure." So I went over and he put this handful in my hand, and it was a giant kernels. And it was amazing. To me, I'd never seen anything so big. I had heard about it in the county, but I'd never seen it. And I don't know what I ever did with it. I just put it in my pocket, and I don't know what happened to it. But anyway, I didn't think about it again for 14 years. And 14 years later, I was just finishing my doctorate degree at UC Davis. I was eating a package of corn nuts one afternoon, just on a break, and just reading the package on my way back to the lab, and it said, "Corn nuts," I said, "made with a giant corn." And I thought, wow, I wonder if corn nuts would be interested in a giant wheat. So I called them up and they said, "Oh yeah, we might be interested in that." And I called my dad and I said, "Dad, see if you can find some of that old King Tut's wheat." And then a week later, he said, "Well, I found some." I found a pint jar about half full, a few heads in it. And he sent me a couple tablespoons and I sent it to corn nuts. And And they called, I called them back in a week or so, and they said, man, this is fantastic. I said, we'll take 10,000 pounds right now. And I said, well, I don't really have 10,000 pounds. I said, I didn't really want to tell them I didn't even have 1 pound. You know, I said, but if you give me a point, we'll grow
a couple
we'll
of
grow
years.
Enough for you. That's right. But I didn't give them any time, you know, lines. But I called my dad right away and I said, Dad, plant the whole thing in the garden. And he did, and he shoveled it out. And then we sent to California and planted over the winter. So we were able to grow two crops a year. For about 3 years, we had over 50 pounds. And then I called Cornuts again, and the guy I talked to originally was gone. No one knew about the project. No one was interested. And so we just put it on a shelf in our shed. And there it sat for four or five years. So we went to our first health food show in Anaheim in 86. And my dad and mother went with me to help me with the booth because I didn't know anything about what I was doing there. And as you know, that never slows me up. I just have to seek more help. And so
That's a good trait of yours, Bob.
Yeah. So I never am deterred by not knowing what I'm doing. But I went to this food show. My dad took this little jar of ancient wheat and he showed everybody. And at the end of the show, my cousin and I, who were in business together, selling stone ground whole wheat flour and Montana grown high protein wheat, had our pockets full of business cards and leads. And we were really excited. And my dad had one lead and one business card, and they're actually the same. And there's a fellow in San Diego who had opened up a macrobiotic store, and he was looking for whole grain and ancient wheat is what we told him. And he said, that's just what I'm looking for. He said, I'll buy everything you got. They said, well, we don't have too much right now, but we'll go home and grow some for you. So we planted all 50 pounds, and that was in 86 and 30 and a half acre. So we started out with a half acre, one farm, no products on the market. And 30 years later, we had 100,000 acres contracted over Montana, Alberta, Saskatchewan, and some of the Dakotas with about 200 organic farmers with over 3,500 products on the market, mostly in Italy.
Wow. So Bob.
It just exploded on us. Yeah.
That's extraordinary. What an innovative moment in agriculture.
Well, it was really fun to give farmers a new crop that we could pay them more than they'd ever been paid for wheat before because there was a demand for it. It not only tasted good, but very soon people started understanding that realizing they felt better when they ate it. And so there were some health benefits that we started researching then, and we found it to be anti-inflammatory, where modern wheat causes inflammation. This is just the opposite. And inflammation is tied to almost all chronic disease. And so people who had diabetes or heart disease or irritable bowel syndrome or anything like that had some relief eating this grain and substituting modern wheat for ancient wheat. And that was astounding to us. But with the double-blind crossover studies that we've done in Italy with human clinical trials, we've been able to demonstrate that this is actually reproducible and is a real effect.
It really makes the moniker, food is your best medicine, hold true.
Yes, yes. Food should be your medicine and medicine should be your food. And Hippocrates taught that 2,300 years ago, and it's finally starting to catch on.
Right on.
Took a while.
Just for a reminder, you're listening to Regenerative Voices, Elevating Stories, Activating Change, and I'm Celine Diaris talking with Bob Quinn, an organic farmer in Montana, and also the author of Grain by Grain, A Quest to Revive Ancient Wheat, Rural Jobs, and Healthy Food. What would you like to, we probably have about 15 minutes we can go. What would you like to talk about next, Bob?
Well, I think that we should talk about, I'd like to just spend part of that time on the high cost of cheap food, because people don't often, they don't think about that very much, because they just want it as cheap as they can get it, and they don't really care how that happens. The way that's happening in America is that farmers it starts at the farm gate, paying the high price of cheap food. Farmers don't receive enough hardly to pay for their cost of production. So they are I'm subsidizing the cost of cheap food by not being able to even make a living.
Right.
And because so many farmers are going broke, about half of my neighbors left in my lifetime. The small towns that used to support are also in decline. So our little town of Big Sandy has gone from 1,000 down to 600 or less now in population. And it's just a vicious cycle. So the next people that pay the high cost of cheap food are small communities because they're no longer being sustained and supported. And people are having to go to cities where there's less and less job opportunities and higher unemployment and tougher living conditions. The next level that pays is our planet. The cost of cleanup of pollution is enormous. And we don't pay that at the checkout counter. We're paying that as taxpayers. We have a dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico that's bigger than New Jersey. How big does it have to get before we realize there's a problem down there? Half the water or a great deal of the water in Iowa isn't fit to drink because of nitrate poisoning. Nitrate,
let's just make that connection, is that this is coming from agricultural inputs being used in what we don't really want to call conventional agriculture, but we'll call chemical intensive agriculture. That is the dominant form of agriculture in the U.S.
Right. And so we have the high, and the cost of that is being pushed out, not by people who are buying those chemicals or eating the food, but by the governments that are involved with cleanup of that mess. And the last area of the high cost of cheap food is being paid with the high cost of healthcare. So 50 years ago, we were paying about 18% of our income went for food. And now we're paying half of that, about 9%. So what are we doing with all the money? Isn't this a great advancement? Food only costs us half as much as 50 years ago. And so does everybody get a new boat or a second home in the country or on the shore or the beach or whatever? Not normally, because most of the money that being spent, used to be spent for food, now is being spent for healthcare. So the cost of healthcare has risen from 9% to about 18%. So they've just flipped. So we're still spending the same amount of money for the two items, but the amount we're spending is just flipped.
And in a much less desirable thing, spending it on bad health outcomes as opposed to healthier food.
And how you feel. So now you're paying less, but you're feeling worse. And I don't think that's a very good trade. And the way chronic disease is increasing in America now, there's not really a way that we're going to be able to afford it in the future. It will cause the collapse of the country economically. When I go to Washington, I go a lot lobbying, and I in the congressional offices, I'm always buttonholing the congressional delegations. And I said, you guys, you know, you're back here spending a lot of time arguing over healthcare programs. And of course, and right now it's a big topic of debate in the presidential election already. And I said, rather than talking about healthcare, I says, which is the best healthcare system? I said, you're asking the wrong question. The question you should be asking is, why are so many people sick? And if you really answered that question, then the healthcare crisis wouldn't be so big, because we wouldn't need such a big healthcare program, because we'd have fewer people sick.
And because we would realize the answer is we need to change the way we're growing food.
Absolutely, because it's really connected to that. By and large, the chronic disease is connected to what we eat. And it's not just as simple as saying, well, stop eating sugar, although that's certainly a serious component. But the quality of the food we're eating is also declining. So if you take all of those together, that is the high cost of cheap food. And the thing that I always like to offer to people is that regenerative organic agriculture holds the keys of solution to all of those things. First of all, it provides better nutrition for food. The farmers receive extra premiums, so they can become profitable now once again. So they receive a fair price for what they grow. Their profitability turns into community profitability. The pollutions that we have from chemical agriculture would go away, which we talked about briefly, and that would be a huge savings. And then the cost of being sick would be reduced. And that would be a huge savings. And if you want to talk about climate change, the carbon sequestration that happens in regenerative organic agriculture, if everybody would change to that, would almost equal the amount of carbon that's been released in the past 50 to 80 years or so, where we've really gone into industrial agriculture. We have to change some other things. We can't just keep dumping the carbon and other greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, but at least we could reverse the damage we've done in that part and reduce the component that is being released in chemical agriculture, particularly with the production of chemical fertilizers.
So
To me, the regenerative organic agriculture is a win-win-win-win answer to so many problems that we are facing now in America and throughout the world. That's why I love going. I'm leaving tomorrow or next week for Mongolia, because they have a national policy to promote organic agriculture, and yet it's in its infancy. And Mongolia is the same latitude as Montana, and so a lot of their agriculture is very similar to what I'm used to. They've asked me to come and help them with some organic conversion. I'm glad to go anywhere in the world to help help people convert to organic and make organic successful.
Well, I'm excited that we're going to have you in Boulder, Colorado in October to share with our convening of the Regenerative Earth Summit with other farmers and ranchers what's potentialized with regenerative organic cultivation of our crops, as to your point, the nutrition element, the water cycle restoration element, and the reduction of all of these toxic inputs that are hurting the earth, the water, and the people.
Yes. So, I mean, I don't know of any other single solution that has so many ramifications than regenerative organic agriculture has. And I know you've asked me many years to come to your conference, and finally we're going to make it happen this year. I'm really excited about that. So thanks for inviting me. I'm looking forward to it. It's only a few weeks off now.
That's right. Well, I'm excited to have you, Bob, and I'm so excited to have you participate in our Regenerative Voices podcast. And I imagine this is just the first of hopefully many other conversations that we'll have, because I think bringing farmers and ranchers' voices forward in this podcast program is an extremely important aspect of this for me, because I think for the public to get to hear from the men and women who are on the front every day on the landscape, helping to grow our food, are our champions, and we want to be a champion for you.
We're all in this together. I tell people, you know, Carlo Petrini and slow food movement in Italy, he said that those people who are eaters are co-producers, because what you eat determines what I grow. So I'm a producer, and you that eat my products are co-producers. I think that's a very nice way to think about it. We're really in this together, and we influence by our actions each other's actions. So if you buy more organic, I'm going to grow more organic. It's as simple as that. And that can change the world.
I think that's a great note to close on. Thank you so much for your time. You are a champion and a hero in my heart. And I thank you for just your devotion to what you're doing, Bob, and that you're carrying this message forward and that you're stewarding in other parts of the world. Awesome. Thank you so much. And I'll just restate Grain by Grain, the book by Bob Quinn with Liz Carlisle. Such a wonderful story, such a beautiful book. It's something you can curl up with literally and enjoy. So I hope.
Show them the picture, Celine.
Yes.
There you go.
For those of you watching on video, there's Bob in the field. And for those of you listening, it's Grain by Grain. You can find it probably at your local bookstore. Just go to a locally owned one, or see if you can go to Bob's website, right, and find the book.
Yes. There's several places online you can find it. But go to your local bookstore first and support those guys. They need the support too. We like to support those folks.
Absolutely. All right. Well, again, thank you so much, Bob. I'll see you soon.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it. Thank you very much for what you do.
The Regenerative Voices, Elevating Stories, Activating Change podcast series is produced by At the Epicenter, a 501c3 nonprofit organization. The podcast and video recordings are made possible by the generous support of people like you. Make a tax-deductible donation or sign up as a monthly supporter by visiting attheepicenter.com/donate. Support packages start at $1 per month. The podcast series is also sponsored by several corporate and organization sponsors. To become a podcast sponsor, visit attheepicenter.com/contact to let us know of your interest. If you found this podcast episode insightful and meaningful, please pass it on by sharing it with a friend or colleague who will also enjoy it. Thank you for tuning in, for your support, and for activating change.